And now we enlighten you with Ayah 35 to 37 of Surah Ali Imran, recited by Shahryar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. ذُرِّيَّةً بَعْضُهَا مِنْ بَعْضٍ وَاللَّهُ سَمِيعٌ عَلِيمٌ إِذْ قَالَتِ امْرَأَةُ عِمْرَانَ رَبِّ إِنِّي نَذَرْتُ لَكَ مَا فِي بَطْنِي مُحَرَّرًا فَتَقَبَّلْ مِنِّي إِنَّكَ أَنْتَ السَّمِيعُ الْعَلِيمُ فلما وضعتها قالت رب إني وضعتها أنثى والله أعلم بما وضعت وليس الذكر كالأنثى وإني سميتها مريم وإني أعيذها بك وذريتها من الشيطان الرجيم فتقبلها ربها بقبول حسن وأنبتها نباتا حسنا وكفلها زكريا كلما دخل عليها زكريا المحراب وجد عندها رزقا قال يا مريم أنى لك هذا قالت هو من عند الله إن الله يرزق من يشاء بغير حساب.
In the name of Allah, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. When the wife of Imran said, "My Lord, dedicate to you what is in my belly in consecration, accept it from me. Indeed, you are the All-Hearing, the All-Knowing." And when she bore her, she said, "My Lord, I have borne a female child, and Allah knew better what she had borne. And the female is not like the male. I've named it Mary, and I commend her and her offspring to your care against evil of the outcast Satan." Thereupon her Lord accepted her with a gracious acceptance and made her grow up in a worthy fashion, and he charged Zechariah with her care. Whenever Zechariah visited her in the sanctuary, he would find provision with her. He said, "O Mary, from where does this come for you?" She said, "It comes from Allah. Allah provides whomever He wishes without any reckoning."
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to Iran Radio, and I'm your host, Asma. I hope you have enjoyed our program up until now. Up next, we have news keeping you updated with the latest headlines. Then we have Radio Productions, delivering another wave of informative content curated just for you by our dedicated team. Next up, the Ocean of Da'a dives deep into spiritual supplications. In this program, we reflect on the rich spiritual heritage of Islamic supplications and ziyarat texts passed down from the Ahlul Bayt as beautifully preserved in Du'a collections like Mafatih al-Jinan. Each episode offers a brief yet meaningful commentary on selected du'as and ziyarat. Following that, another segment of Radio Productions, we've put together a variety of engaging pieces for your listening enjoyment. Discover something new with us. Stay tuned for the news, please.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israeli genocide claims more civilian lives in Gaza as blockaded territory continues to be the scene of destructive strikes by regime forces. Tehran rejects anti-Iran claims by the G7 as baseless and irresponsible, saying group is complicit in Israel's crimes and genocide in occupied Palestine. And U.S. congressman introduces a bill that can deny U.S. citizens a right to travel based solely on their speech, including in criticism of Israel. Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News. Our top story, the genocidal war in Gaza claims more civilian lives as a blockaded territory continues to be the scene of death and devastation. Four civilians were killed and several injured after tents housing displaced families were targeted west of Gaza City, and two more people lost their lives in bombing of several homes in the same area. Israeli forces also blew up homes and residential towers in northern Gaza to force residents to move to central and southern parts of the besieged territory. Seven more Palestinians, including two children, also died from starvation, which raises to 420 total number of hunger-related deaths. U.S. Israeli genocide began in October of 2023 and has so far left over 64,800 Palestinians killed and nearly 165,000 injured. Seems like we have more seven more Palestinians just killed moments ago at breaking news there, and dozens injured after the occupation has bombed another site in Gaza, the Tal al-Hawa area, their residential building. As soon as we get that story developed, we will share it with you accordingly. Also, there you have more breaking news coming in. Another four people killed in southern Gaza near Rafah. Now, Palestinian officials in Gaza have released an alarming report on the extent of destruction of civilian infrastructure in Gaza City since start of the assault in August. The Gaza government media office said regime forces have completely demolished over 1,600 multi-story residential towers and heavily damaged another 2,000 buildings, adding Israeli forces have also destroyed 13,000 tents, sheltering displaced families and forcibly displacing over 350,000 residents. Officials describe Israel's targeting of Gaza City civilians as part of the regime's campaign of systematic destruction, genocide, ethnic cleansing, and forced displacement, and Islam regime's campaign of destruction of Gaza City as blatant violation of international law and the Geneva Conventions. Israeli forces have conducted raids in several towns in the West Bank city of Al-Khalil. Regime forces reportedly arrested a number of Palestinian students in city's two universities. And for more on this, we're now joined by our correspondent in occupied Ramallah, Naka Ahmed. Naka, good to check in with you. A pleasure to see you're safe and doing well. What's the latest you have for us in occupied territories?
Well, today in the West Bank, it seems like we are repeating what's happening over here in the occupied territories as we are living and Palestinians are living in this loop of aggression by the Israeli forces. We are talking about another attacks, another arrests, another raids, and another forms of Israeli and settler aggression. Let me start by the most recent news over here. As now, as I'm talking to you, settlers are attacking and incursing to the Palestinian homes in the village of Safa to the north of the Ramallah city. And Safa has been subjected to many attacks by the Israeli settlers who are trying to cede more land to the ones that have already been seized. We are talking about a village that lost almost 90% of its land. And now the Israeli settlers have continued to attack the Palestinians while they are at their homes and while they are sleeping. Until now, thankfully, there has not been any recorded casualties among the Palestinians, and now it is still an ongoing event as the settlers are still in the village of Im Safa. Another form of aggression is that the Israeli settlers also have attacked the Palestinians to the south of occupied Al Khalil, in the, precisely in Masafer Yatta, we're talking about two assaults, two mainly assaults that happened to the villages of Beirin and to the villages of Atwane, both Bedouin villages that are subjected to many attacks and many many assaults. Overall, in the West Bank, the Israeli forces has raided most of the Palestinian cities. We're talking about incursions towards Nablus, towards Jenin, Tul Kerem, and towards villages of Ramallah, according to the Palestinian Prisoners Club, and more than 10 documented arrests have been documented in the occupied West Bank only in the last 12 hours. Now, also, as we are talking, the village of Deir Jirir is preparing to bid the last farewell to the Palestinian martyr who was announced killed yesterday. The Palestinian young man, Muhammad Isa Alawi, who was shot in the by the Israeli settlers' bullets in the village of Deir Jirir while patrolling and trying to protect the village from the repeated attacks from the Israeli settlers. He was shot along with other three Palestinians in the village. The three Palestinians are still in the hospital being hospitalized. Another headline today, it is quite anticipated and quite actually it's quite followed up by the Israeli media, is that the American Minister of Foreign Affairs Marco Rubio have started today a visit towards the occupied territory.
All right, Naka, stay safe. Pleasure to have that check in with you and get that comprehensive update from you. Naka Hamed joining us from occupied Ramallah. Meanwhile, the UN General Assembly has endorsed a New York Declaration. That's a resolution aimed at advancing a Palestinian statehood. However, measure is sparked some controversy, with critics like Iran arguing it overlooks the root causes of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and fails to recognize the Palestinians' right to self-defense.
Amid rising tensions across West Asia and the genocide in Gaza, the UN General Assembly has adopted a text endorsing a landmark declaration concerning the realization of an independent state of Palestine. The measure is known as the New York Declaration. 142 members voted in favor of it, 10 against, and 12 countries abstained from the vote, including Iran, Iraq, and Tunisia. The declaration, which was already endorsed by the Arab League, seeks to fully exclude Hamas from leadership in Gaza. Iran's UN mission has listed the reasons why it did not vote in favor of the resolution.
The statement fails to adequately address the root causes of the crisis in the West Asia region and does not provide a realistic solution to end the prolonged conflict. The statement ignores the reality of the Zionists' presence in Palestinian territories and their ongoing occupation. The statement irresponsibly shares the responsibility for continuing this long tragedy equally between the apartheid occupying regime and the people under occupation. The statement's attempt to condemn the Palestinian right to legitimate defense on October 7, 2023, and justify the disproportionate and horrific crimes of the Israeli regime against Palestinians. In response to this right is utterly unacceptable and strongly rejected.
Iran's UN mission stressed that lasting peace in the region can only be achieved through the establishment of an independent, sovereign Palestinian state. The UNGA resolution also called for the disarmament of Palestinian resistance groups. Hamas and other groups say this contradicts international law, which recognizes the rights of the people under occupation. The UN General Assembly's vote came less than 24 hours after Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said there would never be a Palestinian state. The New York Declaration vote precedes the upcoming UN summit co-chaired by Riyadh and Paris on September 22 in New York. French President Emmanuel Macron and several other leaders have promised to formally recognize the Palestinian state during the summit. Around three-quarters of the 193 UN member states recognize the Palestinian state proclaimed in 1988 by the exiled Palestinian leadership.
Iran's foreign ministry has strongly condemned allegations made in a joint statement issued by G7 members and allies as unfounded, irresponsible, and pure deflection. Ministry said such baseless accusations against guardians of Iran's national security made by those who've exacerbated insecurity and promoted lawlessness in various regions, in particular West Asia. Say U.S. and other G7 members have to be held accountable for undermining regional security and complicity in genocide in Israel, or in Israel's genocide in Gaza. The statement argued anti-Iran rhetoric is designed to distract global public opinion from what it called the crime of the century against Gazans. Iran called upon G7 nations to amend their erroneous, unjust, and criminal policies. On Friday, G7 charged Iran with transnational repression and targeting political opponents abroad. And staying with the news from Iran, Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi has once again warned three European parties to the 2015 nuclear deal, the JCPOA, about activation of the agreement's so-called snapback mechanism. Araghchi was referring to the JCPOA's dispute resolution clause, which allows for reimposition of UN sanctions against Iran. In a social media post, Araghchi said, "The issue is not just the European Troika or E3 has no legal, political, or moral right to invoke the snapback of it." Added, even if they did, they could not apply it on a use or lose basis. Top Iranian diplomat noted the main dilemma facing E3 is if they use the snapback, they will lose everything. The minister's remarks came a few days after he warned the Troika activation of the snapback will automatically nullify Iran's recent cooperation agreement with the IAEA. And joining us earlier was political analyst Paul Lurdi out of Berkeley, California. He weighed in on the matter as well.
We have to recognize that these three countries, the so-called E3, are essentially puppets, puppet governments of in the control of Israel. And you could say the same thing about Washington as well. What's happening is that Tel Aviv wants, as we've seen time and time again, and especially since 2 years ago, that there is no amount of bloodshed and mayhem and murder that that is enough for Israel. And the more there is war and conflict, the more secure Netanyahu feels. So this is that's the whole purpose of this, really, because it's not as if it's going to bring benefits to the E3 or to the Western countries. It's simply going to create another war, and that's exactly what Israel wants. Israel wants a war with Iran, and it is not going. It's not as if they're going to negotiate in good faith. They're going to push for this, and we'll see what happens.
U.S. congressmen introduced a bill that could potentially be used to deny U.S. citizens right to travel based solely on speech, including in criticism of Israel. The bill has been introduced by Florida Congressman Brian Mass, currently chairs the House Foreign Affairs Committee. The bill comes after Secretary of State Marco Rubio stripped a Turkish doctoral student of her visa based on what a court later found was an opinion piece critical of the Israeli regime. It's ringed alarm bells for civil liberties advocates who say the bill will grant Rubio the power to revoke passports of American citizens on similar grounds. A section of the bill enables Rubio to deny passports to people determined to have knowingly assisted or provided material support to an organization designated as a terrorist outfit. Now, civil liberties and advocates argue that the reference to material support is vague and can be interpreted to include free speech and anti-war activism. Thousands of South Koreans have gathered in central Seoul to protest treatment of country's workers by the U.S. amid President Donald Trump's crackdown on immigrants.
Who would invest in the U.S., a country that illegally arrests people anywhere in the world? With this action, the United States will become isolated globally.
As a Korean citizen, I came out because I felt humiliated by the U.S.
Demonstration followed the return of nearly 300 individuals who've been detained by U.S. immigration authorities. workers were allegedly held for visa violations while employed at a Hyundai-backed electric vehicle battery plant construction site in Georgia. Protesters chanted slogans such as Trump, leave the earth, and let us take revenge on the USA. They also displayed signs bearing anti-US and anti-government messages, including condemn the United States. Seoul protest reflects growing anger over what many consider to be unjust treatment of immigrants and broader discontent with policies associated with the Trump administration. Meanwhile, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea has issued a stern warning asserting planned war games by the U.S., South Korea, and Japan near its borders could have serious repercussions for the three nations. Kim Yo-jong, sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, condemned the drills as reckless demonstration of military power in inappropriate locations. Annual war games known as Freedom Edge are slated to begin Monday. South Korea's military claims drills are intended to enhance aerial, naval, and cyber capabilities in response to what it describes as Pyongyang's nuclear and missile threats. Now, Pak Jong-chan, a DPRK senior party official, also warned Pyongyang will take countermeasures if the three countries continue to flaunt their military might. And North has denounced these war games, characterizing them as rehearsals for an invasion. Beijing has strongly criticized remarks made by U.S. President Donald Trump on use of pressure on China and Russia to end the Ukraine war. Trump proposed imposing tariffs of up to 100% on Chinese purchases of Russian oil would significantly reduce Moscow's revenue. China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi asserted that Beijing advocates for peace negotiations and peaceful resolutions of conflicts through diplomatic dialogue. He affirmed China does not engage in or plan wars. Trump has called on NATO member states to cease purchasing Russian oil and impose stringent sanctions on Moscow. The U.S. president's remarks come as Russia says peace talks with Kiev have been suspended, while Ukraine's accused Russian President Vladimir Putin of seeking to seize all of Ukraine. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Can we not see how the planets look like diamonds in the sky? And everything on earth was created for you and I. Can we not see? Merely waiting for the final day to arrive. To arrive. Do we feel a deeper meaning to it all? And in our creation, there are no flaws, and we're trying to control something we can't explain. Or we wander around blindly in the dark without an aim. Do we think it's all a game? Smiling at your fellow man. all a game? Do we think it's all a game? Do we think it's all a game? Do we think it's all a game?
May peace, blessings, and God's mercy be with you all. The most evident symbol of defeat following the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982 was the occupation of large areas of the country, which culminated in the control of Beirut, the capital. Between August 21 and September 1, 1982, after a siege lasting nearly 2 months, all fighters from the Palestine Liberation Organization and the troops of the Syrian Arab Army left the city. This exit occurred as part of an agreement negotiated under the auspices of the United States, the terms of which included the evacuation of the PLO from Beirut, the withdrawal of the Syrian army from extensive areas of Beirut, its surroundings, and the Mount Lebanon region, a U.S. guarantee of protection for Palestinian refugees who were now unarmed and vulnerable. However, on September 14, 1982, Lebanon was shaken by an event that would mark a turning point, the assassination of Bashir Gemayel. On September 14, 1982, the Israeli army invaded the western neighborhoods of Beirut, which had just emerged from a siege, and ended its occupation the following day, on September 15. However, this date, significant in the contemporary history of the region, still lacks the recognition it deserves in the collective memory of the Arab and Lebanese people. Beirut was the second Arab capital occupied by Israel after Al-Quds. This direct occupation was achieved after the enemy realized the initial war objectives we mentioned earlier, specifically the expulsion of the PLO from Beirut and the scattering of its members across various Arab capitals, distancing them from Palestine. In addition to the withdrawal of the Syrian army from Beirut and its surroundings, as well as from Mount Lebanon and parts of the Bekaa. The fulfillment of these objectives, combined with the Israeli military pressure and U.S. political influence, marked what was seen as the significant defeat of Israel's enemy forces in Lebanon. This defeat was particularly painful due to the high number of martyrs. Although there are no official figures, local estimates report at least 18,000 dead and tens of thousands injured, along with the near-total devastation of western Beirut. As previously mentioned, the Israeli enemy laid an unyielding siege on Beirut for over 2 months, cutting off access to food, water, and medicine for its residents. However, the tragedy did not end with the departure of the PLO and the Syrian troops. On the contrary, Beirut and other Lebanese areas became the sites of horrific massacres, carried out by both the Israeli occupying forces and their local collaborators. Among these, Sabra and Shatila stand out as the most horrific, not only due to their scale, but also because they occurred after the assurances given by U.S. Special Envoy Philip Habib to Yasser Arafat. Habib had promised that Palestinian refugees would not be attacked once the PLO fighters left the city. Thousands of Palestinians and Lebanese lost their lives in these massacres. Beyond the physical massacres, the tragedy of Sabra and Shatila went beyond the horror of the killings to inflict an even deeper wound, the fracture of the collective will of its victims. While it's not within our power to prevent the enemy from committing crimes, Giving up our tools of resistance condemns us to powerlessness, preventing us even from attempting to preserve our dignity and existence. The defeat experienced by Lebanese, Palestinians, and Syrians in this battle, along with the accompanying massacres, marked one of the epicenters of failure in this war. One of its more cruel features was the Israeli enemy's attack on the second Palestinian generation after the Nakba, a systematic attempt to break their spirit of resistance. The Nakba of 1948 not only displaced the people, but also created a first generation defined by survival and resistance against various forms of annihilation. Their resilience in a context where official Arab regimes led the confrontation with Israel allowed for the emergence of a second generation affected by the Nakba. This group was not limited to Palestinians in Lebanon. It also included Arabs and international volunteers who, whether directly, like the Lebanese, or indirectly, like foreign fighters in the ranks of Palestinian factions, were impacted by its consequences. The second generation began its struggle after the defeat of 1967 and solidified its presence within the PLO and Palestinian factions. This framework provided them with the chance to prepare, organize, and confront the enemy, culminating in the significant test of 1982, following nearly 15 years of battles and confrontations. The policy of massacres and the devastation of the Lebanese landscape had a clear objective: to annihilate this generation. Had they succeeded, Israel would have instilled a state of inherited hopelessness, passed down to future generations, doomed to oscillate between indifference and unconditional surrender to its designs. In this regard, Israel achieved, at least partially, its goal. The 1982 war marked the beginning of the end for the PLO experience, and its subsequent entry into the tunnel of Arab normalization with Israel, solidified at the Madrid Conference in 1991. This process generated a wave of cultural and psychological rejection among broad sectors of the elites and the population of the 1982 generation. The rejection manifested in two ways: commitment to normalization, justifying collaboration with the enemy, and undeclared surrender, expressed in the acceptance of the enemy's superiority and the search for the causes of defeat in essentialist stereotypes, such as the supposed inherent weakness of the Arab character, a pseudo-scientific and irrational argument, yet revealing of the moral collapse following the failure. Regarding the most evident manifestation of Israel's defeat or victory in the 1982 war, it only became clear 11 years later, as we noted in the episode's introduction. The political victory for Israel in the 1982 war specifically emerged in 1993, when the Oslo Accords were signed. This agreement between the Palestine Liberation Organization and the Israeli occupying entity marked the abandonment of the rights of the Palestinian people and their submission to the diktats of the Israeli enemy. Its impact continues to this day, ideologically normalizing collaboration with the enemy under the euphemism of security coordination, and practically with the Palestinian Authority playing a repressive role over the population in the occupied West Bank. The Oslo Accords were merely the final stage of the path of defeat laid out by Israel in 1982. This process aligns with what Ariel Sharon defined as the long-term goal of the occupation of Beirut: to facilitate control over the West Bank, in contradiction to the immediate decisions made in the heat of the invasion. Contrary to what Israel aimed for in June 1982, an unexpected path emerged, the face of victory. This victory, evident from the early days of the invasion, was showcased through the legendary resistance on multiple fronts, even in light of the initial collapse that marked the war's onset. Palestinians, Lebanese, soldiers and officers of the Syrian Arab Army engaged in epic battles across every corner of the territory, from the camps of Rashidiya and Burj al-Shamali, through the fighting in Sidon and Ain el-Hilwa, to the crucial battles of Sultan Yaqub in the Bekaa and Ain Dara in Mount Lebanon. Additionally, the tactical creativity of the heroes of the Syrian Arab Army, along with the fierce resistance in Khalda and the very heart of Beirut, played a significant role. This reality was captured with honesty and impact by the Lebanese newspaper Al-Safir, which headlined on its front page, "Beirut is burning, but it does not raise white flags." Every act of resistance, despite strategic differences and the initial devastating blow, posed an insurmountable challenge to the future that Israel sought to impose from its tanks. Simultaneously, these actions laid the groundwork for a cumulative effort that gained momentum in September 1982, driven by the operations of the Lebanese National Resistance Front, which included the Communist Party, the Organization of Communist Action, the Syrian Social Nationalist Party, and the Nasserist factions, along with the actions of the Amal movement and the emerging Islamic resistance. Within occupied Beirut, the occupying army faced daily setbacks until they were forced to withdraw from the city on September 29, 1982. On that same day, Israeli military loudspeakers broadcast a discouraging message. Oh, residents of Beirut, do not open fire. We are in retreat. Although Beirut had fallen militarily on August 19, 1982, following the evacuation agreements between the PLO and the Syrian Arab Army, mediated by the United States, and despite Israel occupying the city on September 15th, the very next day, September 16th, the launch of the Lebanese National Resistance Front was announced. On September 29, 1982, Beirut was liberated, becoming the first Arab capital reclaimed by its people in record time. This milestone undoubtedly marked the official scene of victory in 1982. As for the overall manifestation of victory, it was the failure of the remaining Israeli objectives of the war. As we mentioned, the enemy had established three fundamental objectives for the war. First, the expulsion of the PLO. Second, the withdrawal of the Syrian Arab Army from Beirut. And finally, and most importantly, the establishment of a Lebanese government aligned with its interests. It achieved the first two, and the third seemed to be on track, incorporating Lebanon into its sphere of influence. However, the assassination of Bashir Gemayel and the subsequent withdrawal of the occupying forces from Beirut did not halt the political project he represented. On the contrary, the Lebanese government, headed by Amin Gemayel, Bashir's brother, signed the May 17, 1983 agreement, which normalized relations with Israel and placed Lebanon under its sovereignty. However, this agreement was overthrown by the February 6, 1984 uprising led by the Amal movement, the Progressive Socialist Party, and National and Islamic forces with decisive Syrian support under the leadership of the late President Hafez al-Assad. Ultimately, the third Israeli objective failed. Moreover, the Syrian army, expelled from Beirut in 1982, returned years later, consolidating its presence alongside the Lebanese resistance in the period between the liberation of Beirut in 1982 and the February 6, 1984 uprising, which annulled the May 17, 1983 agreement and weakened the pro-Israeli and pro-Western regime in Lebanon. The same period witnessed continuous operations in the south, the Bekaa, and Beirut against the Israeli occupation forces. The most emblematic milestone of the resistance at the time was the operation of November 11, 1982, when Ahmed Ghassir, known as Son of the South, drove a car bomb against the headquarters of the Israeli military governor in Tyre, causing the death of 90 Israeli soldiers and officers. At the same time, Lebanon was the scene of decisive operations against Western multinational military forces led by the United States. On November 23, 1983, two coordinated truck bomb attacks carried out by two individuals, whose names have not been revealed to this day, simultaneously destroyed the U.S. Marines headquarters in Beirut and the French paratroopers' headquarters. The outcome was strategic. 241 U.S. and 58 French soldiers lost their lives, forcing the multinational forces to abandon Lebanon. These forces, far from being peacekeepers, had actively participated in attacks against the Lebanese population, including civilian areas, using warships, aircraft, and indiscriminate bombings. Many Lebanese still remember the U.S. battleship New Jersey, which bombed Beirut, its suburbs, and Mount Lebanon. During that same period, the U.S. Embassy in Beirut was the target of two attacks. In April 1983, a car bomb completely destroyed it, and in September 1984, a second explosion hit the new building in Aukar, north of Beirut, but did not completely destroy it. Ultimately, both militarily and politically, the joint Israeli-U.S. project in Lebanon collapsed in less than 2 years. By April 1985, just 3 years after the start of the invasion, the Israeli army had almost completely withdrawn from Mount Lebanon, from most of the West Bekaa, from Sidon and its surroundings, from the city of Tyre and its surroundings, and from the Nabatea area. It only retained control of the border strip with Palestine, which would finally be liberated through an operation in May 2000. Although the regional and international reality of 1982 was far from that of today, the cowardice of the Arab regimes was already evident, but not as much as in recent years from 2023 to today. It's true that the field of normalization had not yet reached the peak it has reached today, but suffice it to note that a few days after the destruction of Beirut, instead of a forceful response, what followed was an Arab summit in Morocco, specifically in the city of Fes, held between September 6th and 9th, 1982. Added, Arab leaders adopted the Saudi Peace Initiative we mentioned a moment ago, presented years earlier in 1981 by the then Crown Prince Fahd bin Abdulaziz. In other words, after Israeli occupied an Arab capital, following this grave event, how did the Arab regimes respond? Instead of condemning the aggression, the Arab regimes presented Israel with a peace initiative that recognized the existence of a state called Israel in the Palestinian territories occupied before June 4, 1967. However, there was a fundamental difference between the then Arab position and now: Syria. Under the leadership of the late President Hafez al-Assad, Syria became the backbone that thwarted the Israeli-American project in Lebanon. Meanwhile, Iran, despite being immersed in its war against the regime of former Iraqi President Saddam, supported by the Persian Gulf states, the West, and the Soviet Union, actively supported the Lebanese resistance. From Syrian territory and across the Syrian-Lebanese border, Iran trained and supported forces opposing the occupation, even while the Soviet Union remained present in the region. It's true that during the Israeli invasion of Beirut in 1982, the Soviet Union betrayed its historic allies, the PLO and the Lebanese National Movement. According to testimonies collected by Ghassan Charbel, editor-in-chief of the Saudi newspaper Middle East, in articles published on or after August 29, 2023, figures such as the martyr George Hawi, former Secretary General of the Lebanese Communist Party, and the late Hani al-Hassan, leader of the Al-Fatah movement, reveal that the Soviet ambassador in Beirut at that time, that is in June 1982, refused to take any measures to support the PLO and the Lebanese National Movement, even symbolic ones, such as the deployment of a warship off the coast of the capital. Instead, the Soviet diplomat advised Yasser Arafat to leave Beirut, even if it meant leaving on board a U.S. warship. All of this is true. However, on November 22, 1982, just months after the Israeli occupation of Beirut, the death of Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev and his replacement by Yuri Andropov marked a radical change. The USSR then began a process of rebuilding and strengthening the Syrian Arab Army, severely depleted after the clashes with Israel on Lebanese territory, both on the ground and in the air. The result was overwhelming. By December 1983, the Syrian Air Force and its anti-aircraft defenses had regained operational capability to the point of shooting down a U.S. fighter jet over the Baqa Valley in Lebanon. The captured pilot remained in Syrian hands until January 1984, when he was released thanks to the mediation of American cleric Jesse Jackson. In short, the regional and international landscape of the time maintained a strategic balance that supported the resistance against Israel in Lebanon. The two fundamental external pillars of this front were Syria, supported by the Soviet Union, and the Islamic Republic of Iran. What we discussed about 1982 was not intended to pass historical judgment or compile a detailed record of events. The central objective of everything we said was to draw lessons. That year showed us that the course of history is not determined exclusively by those in power who plan wars or alter realities. Instead, there is a decisive and often underestimated factor, the will of the oppressed. This will not only challenge the imposed destiny, but also opens up the possibility of rewriting it, charting an alternative course for events. It's undeniable that material factors, regional support, and state structure influence the future of peoples. It's also true that in the Arab Levant, reality has radically transformed, especially following Syria's transition at the end of 2024, which transformed from a bastion of resistance to a laboratory for normalization. However, the origin of all transformation remains in the will of the indigenous peoples, in their refusal to accept that the destruction of their capital and its occupation marked the end of their history. They firmly rejected the imposition of a subordinate political system on Lebanon by Israel and the United States. On the contrary, it was that same will that altered the course of events. The indigenous peoples of this land managed to liberate their capital in record time, despite being besieged, occupied, and without any direct support. At that time, the regional and international balance did not favor the oppressed. Israel did not act alone. It had the backing of the U.S. Army, which not only supported it, but fought alongside it, replacing its troops alongside those of France, Italy, and other allies. The Lebanese capital lay in ruins, and the military and material defeat seemed absolute. However, the will of the people was not broken. It became the most powerful and costly weapon, the decisive factor that transformed the threat of 1982 into an opportunity for rebirth. It was this will that made possible the liberation of 1985, the Israeli withdrawal in 2000, the containment of the Israeli Merkava tanks in Wadi al-Hijr in 2006, the limitation of the invasion to the Lebanese border villages in 2024, the resistance we are witnessing today in Gaza, after nearly 2 years of a war of extermination. Every war is, in essence, a test. It assesses the conditions prior to its outbreak. But it also tests the capacity for planning, execution, and above all, the strength of will. At the same time, it marks the death of one reality and the birth of a new one. Those who initiate a conflict attempt to shape this new reality according to their designs, with reflection and calculation. But like any explosion in life, war can generate unexpected paths, even for those who plan it. This is the fundamental lesson we learned from the 1982 occupation of Beirut. See you next week in a new episode, God willing.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
The Ocean of Dua.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على محمد وآله الطاهرين.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of the Ocean of Dua. And in this version of the program, we are trying to cover some of the names of the Almighty Allah that are recommended to be recited to invoke Him for obtaining benefits. So stay with us.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum wa al'an adahum ajma'in.
Among the other names of the Almighty Allah to be recited in the beginning of our du'as, or while we are reciting du'a and invoking Him, is the name Al-Kabir, the greatest. So the Almighty Allah is Kabir and great in any aspect. So by resorting to this Kabir, this Kabirul Muta'al, the greatest, the exalted, of course, all the things we are mentioning in this program, dear listeners, have some different conditions to be met if we want to achieve the results. But whatever happens, reciting these names of the Almighty Allah will bring more the attraction of the Almighty Allah, and we can gain more benefits, especially while we are invoking Him and reciting dua. Another name, dear listeners, is Al-Kareem, the kind, which is closely related to Al-Afuv, the forgiver.
Alhamdulillahi malik al-mulk, mujri al-fulk, musakhir al-riyah, faliq al-isbah, dayan al-deen, rabb al-alameen. الحمد لله على حلمه بعد علمه والحمد لله على عفوه بعد قدرته والحمد لله على طول أناته في غضبه وهو قادر على ما يريد الحمد لله خالق الخلق باسط الرزق فالق الإصباح ذي الجلال والإكرام والفضل والإنعام الذي بعد فلا يرى وقرب فشهد النجوى.
Al-Kafi, or the effective, is another name. This literally means that the Almighty Allah is enough and we do not need to turn and resort to anyone else. Some people do not believe that the Almighty Allah is the effective. Some people believe in their relatives more than they do in the Almighty Allah. And this is in total contrast in believing in this name of the Almighty Allah, Al-Kafi, the effective. So why do we have to turn and ask anybody else? And the last name that will be mentioned in this program, dear listeners, is Al-Kashif. Al-Kashif is another name that literally means the disperser. Since the Almighty Allah is the only one that we can refer to for our deliverance, returning to other people and resorting to others other than Him is negating this name. So, Al-Kashif is the disperser. We have been ordered to recite Ya Kashif al-Durri Ayyub many times daily to drive away sorrow, anxiety, diseases, and poverty. Ya Kashif al-Durri Ayyub means, oh, he who removed the hardships of Ayyub. Even the names of the Almighty Allah are a cure for the true servants, but only on condition of knowing and believing in Him.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean, and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad. Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. experience that realization that you need God, and the merciful God will come towards you.
The ocean of dua.
We have some verses about this great prophet of the Almighty Allah in chapter the prophets al-anbiya in the Holy Quran. Since he was a true servant of the Almighty Allah, he was always thankful to him and worshipped him throughout his life. Satan asked the Almighty Allah to dominate over his wealth, and then he asked the Almighty Allah to dominate over his family and dear ones. And in the last step, he could dominate over his body. So everything he had was taken away from him. But the more it was taken from him, his thankfulness increased. After he had passed his exam successfully, the Almighty Allah says, فَاسْتَجَبْنَا لَهُ. We answered to him and we delivered him because he was patient. So by saying, يَا كَاشِفَ ضُرِّ أَيُّوبِ, O you who removed the hardship of Ayyub, we can ask the Almighty Allah to drive away our sorrows and anxieties and diseases as he did for his prophet Ayyub. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program as well. We ask the Almighty Allah to bestow on us the power and bravery that we never be afraid of the mass of the enemies, nor we fear from the dreadful events. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Loving.
Prophet Muhammad climbed down in despair, engraved in his heart were the words of his Lord. To all of mankind, this was his call. La ilaha illallah, Muhammadu Rasulullah. Oh people, praise only Allah, glorify
in the small central city of Mahallot, a small town that is mostly famous for its flowers. But here, I've come across something that I'm sure you're going to find interesting too.
The city is famous for an ancient water spring called Sar Chishme, flowing from the mountains in the north to the plain areas of the south. Many villages were built around the water spring since the Achaemenid era, eventually developing into the city that you see today. And this is where Mahallot, meaning several neighborhoods, gets its name from. It's no wonder that a city this old should have its own very unique souvenirs. Maybe some kind of sweet with a very interesting story about how and why it was invented. And this is what I'm telling you about today. Now sesame seeds and the oily paste produced from grinding them, called tahini, are known to all. But the kind of sweet they're turned into in Mahallot is definitely unique.
The sesame that is used here is produced in Iran. They say that this sesame will give us a better quality tahini. Now, in order to get a creamy tahini with that nutty flavor, we have to roast seeds in the oven for at least 20 minutes.
Sesame seeds may be tiny, but they have huge health benefits, and this is probably the best way to include them in your daily diet, especially if you have a sweet tooth.